Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 3, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Malankyavada Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches Malankyaputta to not lose focus from seeking answers to inappropriate questions, questions that would only distract from the purpose of the Dhamma. There is a related article on the website, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So, today's talk on the Kula Malankyavada Sutta. The Buddha was at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. One of the monks of the Sangha, Malankyaputta, was in seclusion when the thought occurred to him, the Buddha does not give an answer when asked certain questions, such as, is the cosmos eternal or not eternal? Is the cosmos finite or infinite? Does a body have a soul or not? Does an awakened person exist after death, or do they not exist after death, or do they both exist and not exist, or neither of these? Talk about circular logic. But those ideas were presented in the Vedas and later in the Upanishads as realistic questions that we should ponder and actually develop an answer to these questions within ourselves. Something that the Buddha studied and rejected. Malankyaputta continues with his thoughts. I don't accept that the Buddha refuses to answer these questions. I will seek him out and ask him about this. If his answers satisfy me, then I will continue as his disciple. If he refuses to answer me, I will leave the Sangha. If you've read the article in the Pali Canon on my website, that's exactly what happened during the Second Council when the Mahasanghikas wanted a more mystical and visionary type of Dhamma practice influenced by the Vedas. And when the Sangha refused, they formed their own sect of so-called Buddhism. And that was the beginning of what would lead to today, to the Mahayana form of Buddhism, which really began as a Protestant form, something that was in direct contradiction to what the Buddha was teaching. And if you look at, again, I'm not putting anything down, just pointing out the differences. But if you look at many of the modern tenets of Mahayana Buddhism, they have more in common with what is in the Vedas and the Upanishads, which developed into modern Hinduism. They have more akin to modern Hinduism than due to the Buddha's original teachings. And it all goes back to this idea of finding the Buddha's teaching unsatisfying in answering these great, great questions and sometimes not so great questions. That evening, Malankyaputta went to the Buddha and upon greeting the Buddha with a bow, sat to one side. Great teacher, I have been pondering why you do not provide a satisfying answer to these questions. And he repeats those questions. If you can answer these questions based on your knowing, I will remain a disciple. If you cannot answer these questions from not knowing, I will leave the Sangha. Malankyaputta, did I ever tell you or even imply that my teaching would answer these questions or that these questions even deserve an answer? No, great teacher. Well then, why are you claiming a grievance or making a demand of me? If you threaten to leave the Sangha unless these questions are answered by me, then you should leave the Sangha. There's a few things that are arising here. One is, it's the Malankyaputta is describing his dissatisfaction with what the Buddha is teaching. Dukkha occurs even within the Dhamma, especially when we want the Dhamma to be different than it is. Rather than answer what the Buddha said his Dhamma provides the answers for and the solution to. The common human problem of confused and deluded thinking that leads to continual unsatisfactory experiences, even within the Dhamma. The Buddha continues, you are like a man who has been wounded by a poisonous arrow. His friends brought him to a surgeon, but they refused to have the arrow removed until they know who shot the arrow, their position, their physical attributes, and even what type of bow they used. They further delay the action that will save them by insisting on knowing what type of animal the arrow feathers are from and the type of wood it is composed of. So the Buddha is just describing the getting caught up in our own thicket of views and using that thicket of views to continue ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha is saying these questions don't even relate in any way to what he's teaching. And notice he's not saying in a general way you shouldn't ask any of these questions. He's just saying as it applies to the Dhamma, they're irrelevant. Let go of the questions. And this is a common theme. You heard me talk about Vajragoda often too. Vajragoda is the guy that keeps coming in and out of the Buddha's life asking these same questions. And the Buddha would say, usually your questions are what's confusing you. Let go of the questions. And Vajragoda would get up in a huff and walk away. He'd come back a year later with the same questions. Much like Malankiputta. All of these questions have nothing to do with the matter at hand. These people will die never knowing the answers to these foolish questions, which only prove to be a distraction from what is most important. In that case, getting the arrow out. Whatever your view is of these questions, the right view is dukkha occurs, craving originates, and clinging perpetuates dukkha. Cessation of this process is possible, and the Eightfold Path is the path developing cessation. I do not answer these questions as they are not fundamental with the goal. They do not develop this enchantment, this passion. They do not develop calming in the mind, unbinding. They do not develop direct knowledge. They do not develop awakening. What was that? Kofifi.
Develop and direct. Oh,
God. This is why I do not answer these questions. Again, the Buddha is just pointing out to keep your focus on what he's teaching. I do make it very clear that dukkha occurs, craving originates, and clinging continues dukkha. Cessation of this process is possible. The Eightfold Path develops cessation. And again, the Buddha keeps coming back. This is the same theme, the same topic that he taught for 45 years. Yet there are always people coming wanting answers to these other questions that were just a distraction. And of course, we tend to do that sometimes in a more practical way, even the thought that I'm just too busy right now to meditate. I'm too distracted right now. I have too many things going on to even consider the Eightfold Path. We're still distracted by these other things that really have nothing to do with the matter at hand, or they would be addressed directly by developing the Dhamma. I make this very clear for one purpose. This develops disenchantment, dispassion, with calm, with unbinding, with direct knowledge, and with awakening. This is why I teach the Dhamma. Always remember what I teach and what I do not teach. Having heard these words, Malankaputta was satisfied and went on his way. That's the end of the sutta. I'm just going to read a few more comments. Much like the Buddha's encounters with Vajragoda and others, the Buddha knew that answering any questions that would only lead to more ignorance and confusion was cruel. In other words, the essence of true compassion from an awakened point of view is to point to the Dhamma and not get into something that a self-referential ego self might require a teacher to answer, such as, I have all the answers. And wouldn't have been almost expected, in fact it was common in the Buddhist time and it's still common today, that any great teacher would have the answers to every question. We would almost expect it, wouldn't it? But the Buddha didn't care how people looked at him in that way, as some supernatural being that had all the answers to every single question that might arise. His only focus was recognizing and abandoning the individual contributions to suffering. That's what he taught. Of course, that is the most important thing that we can learn, isn't it? The nature of our own confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences. And that's why he taught what he taught. It really does take great compassion married with wisdom to understand that. Because without that, you could almost develop this understanding that you owe it to someone to provide the answers when you don't understand where the answers are coming from. Because you could see that as someone has a disturbed quality of mind and you want to alleviate that without the understanding that that's just creating more confusion in that person. I have all the answers. In fact, it's not even that you don't want to put yourself up as I have all the answers, but like the Buddha shows, The questions themselves are irrelevant. They don't lead to anything. What good does it do anyone? It's kind of, we talked a little bit about this on Thursday night in the question of faith in Buddhism. Even if you can answer the question somehow, is the cosmos finite or infinite? Does the soul progress from life to life? What does that do to developing understanding? It doesn't answer any question. In fact, if you can state categorically that, yes, I know that the soul progresses from one life to the next life and on and on and on, you're encouraging continued eye-making, aren't you? Of course, the Buddha realized that there's no such thing as a soul that progresses from one life to the next. We're simply always in a process of becoming. And then the question is, what am I becoming in this moment? Am I becoming awakened, or am I contributing to continue to becoming more ignorant in a life based on that ignorance? Rather than be distracted by his own need to mollify his students or prove how knowledgeable he might be, he remains silent when asked, I'm referring to the Buddha, of course, he remains silent when asked questions that are rooted in ignorance and only seek to further ignorant self-referential views. Through great compassion rooted in profound wisdom and clear vision, through great compassion rooted in profound wisdom and clear vision, the Buddha consistently spared his disciples any teaching that did not directly develop his stated purpose of understanding suffering and the path developing the cessation of suffering. That's the end of the article. And just one more comment, and if you know who I'm referring to, I don't mean any disrespect to this person. If you don't know, try not to think about who I'm referring to, because it's really not that important. I'm using something that a very famous modern Buddhist teacher said that directly leads to more confusion and really contradicts what the Buddha just said. Anyway, this person recently said, and they said it over and over again, that if science somehow proves that the Buddhist teachings are not in fact true, that we should disregard the teachings. Of course, that's assuming that science is trying to answer some of these great questions, which is really what they are doing in some ways. And it's interesting. I've always been interested in quantum mechanics and quantum physics, but not to give relevancy to the Buddha's Dhamma, just because they are interesting questions, such as, is there such a thing as a God particle or some an original spark of life to the universe? That's interesting to me. But it's not the same as developing the Dhamma, and you can easily get lost in that. And so if somehow, and let me say it this way, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, they have nothing in relation to any of these topics even. They're just directing our attention to the common human problem of confused, deluded thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Science has nothing to do with that. And it's really, science is an ongoing expression of the impermanence of facts, isn't it? And again, I'm not putting down science. We develop science. Science is always in a continual state of impermanence, and developing views rated based on what we currently understand. I mean, it wasn't all that long ago that we insisted that the world was flat, that type of thing. And science proved it at that point. Of course, we know that's not true. The Four Noble Truths speak to one specific issue, the issue of ongoing ignorance that leads to confusion, delusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences. And that's what the Buddha taught, and he was pretty successful at it. So that's the end of the talk. Any questions about this? Staying focused on the Dhamma.
I have a question.
Please.
I don't view reincarnation, I think, the way a lot of people do, but if you view it the way traditionally we look at reincarnation, doesn't that require a scientific explanation as to whether we can come back as in a new form?
Oh, I certainly could.
And that does relate to Buddhism.
No, it doesn't. And that's where the Buddha, it relates to modern Buddhism, because modern Buddhism claims that there is a soul in some way. And sometimes I don't use the word, but they talk about an ongoing Buddha nature or something like that. But the Buddha never taught that a soul transmigrates from one life to the next life. He simply taught that what we should be mindful of is the ongoing process of becoming. And what are we going to become? I had this talk with someone yesterday. I can't remember who it was. So the Buddha used similar terms that were common at the time arising out of the Vedas, such as karma, but he explained it in a different way, and rebirth as opposed to reincarnation. Reincarnation assumes that there is somehow an inner soul that progresses from the same soul progresses, the same self-identity progresses from one lifetime to the next lifetime to the next lifetime. There's whole Buddhist lineages that are based on that. The Dalai Lama is the same soul. He's the 16th now, I think, of the same individual soul that keeps reincarnating. The Kagyu lineage that I took vows in, is the 16th Karmapa, is the same soul that has been reincarnating. That's a common belief in that form of Buddhism. The Buddha didn't teach anything like that. He did not say that there's no such thing as a future rebirth, but that the individual is always in a constant process of becoming. And the best way that I can explain that is, think of yourself at 5 years old. You are seemingly in the same body. You would argue that point, that this is still me. Mm-hmm. But even science proves that every cell in your body changes every 7 years or so. And even science can prove that you are not the same physical person as you were when you walked in here a half hour ago. There's millions of additional cells that are part of your body that weren't part of your body. That we're always in that constant process of becoming. So who we are can never be fixed in time. Where we get caught, and the reason why they make where these notions of a soul, an individual soul migrating from one life to the next life, is because we don't understand that the same process that occurs from one moment to the next moment, a completely different body, but that happens so quickly that we don't pick it up, is the same process that's occurring from a physical death to another physical life. There's no individual continuity. There's only continuity of either an ignorant mind or an awakened mind. The individual, when we focus on the individual, or the soul, or an individual having a soul, that we get caught up in continued self-identity. This is my soul. And when we do that, then we get into other practices such as, which is very common in Buddhism and most religions, of acting in a certain way right now, so that in the future I'll have my reward in heaven, or a future of favorable rebirth, and that's a confusion of karma. So getting back to the Buddha's difference between using karma is a present moment unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by whatever we're holding in mind in this moment. And if we're holding in mind the Eightfold Path, then we're inclining our minds towards awakening. Now, just to make one more point on what you asked, when the Buddha awakened, he's not doing it in there, he touched the ground, and he said a bunch of things, but he said, there's nothing further for me in this world. There will be no further becoming. The well-integrated, it's usually called the holy life, the well-integrated life has been lived. For me, there will be no future rebirths. What is he saying? He's talking about future physical rebirths, but most importantly, he's talking about, for me, for a self-referential ego self, there's nothing left that can give birth to that again. He lived free the next 45 years of his life, the last 45 years of his life. He left free of the burden. You've heard me say that often too. He put down the burden of a self-referential ego self.
But isn't that sort of the carrot on the stick, is that if you lead an awakened life that you won't go through rebirth? Much like, if you lead
yes,
a life, you'll go to heaven?
Yes, but that's a realistic goal. And it's an achievable goal rather than something that's not based in reality. And so you point to something that I don't talk about often simply because I feel that it can create a distraction from what's occurring right now. But yeah, the goal of the Dhamma is to not have any more births, to get out of this. Why? The First Noble Truth says when you have a human life, when the Buddha describes suffering, the first reference to suffering is birth. Birth is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Not getting what you want is suffering. Getting what you don't want is suffering. In short, he always closes, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates simply describe the personal experience of ongoing suffering. Rather than being enamored with the world, which is what an ego does. Why? Because an ego sees itself in everything that occurs. Every thought, every event, every idea that occurs is a self-referential thought from an ego point of view. And so, no matter how much suffering there is in the world, in a general global sense, or individually, the ego is enamored with it. It's wonderful because it's established in the world. The Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his own awakening, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. The word Nagara refers to the world. The Loka Sutta also does in a certain, the different translations of the Pali. Loka means the world, Nagara means the world. In the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha's talking about, and he goes through the process of his own awakening, extracting himself from all the self-referential views he had in connection, clinging to the world. So we think that the world is just a wonderful place, and why wouldn't we want to keep coming back and having this wonderful experience? And it's, I'm not saying that our lives stink, but the most important part of our lives, we can take great pleasure in some of the things of the world as long as we don't create identities by that. Because if we do, we're simply continuing to the karma of continuing suffering. So then that when you say something like, great questions, Anthony. When you say, well, the real point of the goal of the Dhamma is to end suffering forever, meaning you stop creating the conditions for your own physical life, almost immediately those questions will pop back into your head, won't they? Well, then what happens after I'm gone? What
or
happens?
How do I get there? What am I doing? What am
so,
I doing?
And that,
to
yes,
get there?
That's yeah. The self-referential view. That's where we get stuck. And I would bet that we probably all had that question when I said the whole point is to not do this anymore. Well, what happens to me? What's the payoff for me? The payoff for me is a physical life in this lifetime of lasting peace and happiness because you're free of the burden of a self-referential ego self. It's the whole point of the Dhamma. And in that way, if there is such an experience, you know, I'm speculating on something the Buddha said, don't do it. So let me bring it back to true reality. It really
okay,
doesn't.
You could speculate.
Well, it doesn't matter. This is a true teaching on the present moment. There's all these great things, you know. Again, I'm not putting anybody down. The power of now, to be in the present moment. They missed the mark because there's no such thing as the present moment. But the payoff is to be completely mindful of your life as your life unfolds. That's it. And the ego wants to say, what else? There's got to be more. That's the catch. And when you're looking for more, the second noble truth says the craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. It's that need for more that's craving. Yeah. And I need it more right now. I need to establish myself in more. And I always need more. Maura and I used to go to this restaurant. Again, I'll mention a restaurant. But it's a somewhat famous restaurant nearby, a few towns away. And we noticed something about the owners, a very affable restaurateur. You know, guy knows how to treat people up to a certain point. But he always makes every single patron, Jen might know because it's close to her house, he always makes every single patron feel like the next patron is the most important one. In other words, he rushes you through your dinner. And he's kind of pointing you out the door even before he sits you down. The next diner is going to be the one that brings his nest egg in. That's how he makes you feel. It's always, and I'm just using him as an example. We all do that. It's always the next thing that's going to make me happy. The next thing that's going to make me secure. The next thing that's going to satisfy this self-referential ego self. It's insatiable. It can't be satisfied. It's the nature of an ego self to be unsatisfied. Dukkha occurs. The five clinging aggregates are the nature of suffering, the personal experience of it. So the great questions and the great solutions to those questions, like I have a soul and I have this identity I can carry with me from one lifetime to the next. You think about that. If the point of awakening is that you can do it right now and, you, as the Buddha said, you should take to it like your hair is on fire. When you have an infinite number of lifetimes to solve the problem, you don't really have to take to it too quickly or too diligently, do you? The Buddha often says that the wise understand the danger in even the slightest transgression. Why? Because they understand that even the slightest transgression is going to keep the whole process of dukkha going. So again, it's not really the carrot on a stick in the sense that the goal is to never come back, to never give yourself rebirth. In that physical sense, the carrot is that we can awaken in this moment and live a life, as however many years we have left, a life of lasting peace and happiness, and that's what the Buddha taught. The other things are really a distraction. So, thank you. And it also shows great insight into the implications of the Dhamma to ask questions like that. In other words, the questions were framed correctly. So I think the Buddha would answer those questions too.
I hope so.
Debbie.
But if I'm understanding it right, the Buddha taught, what you just explained, but he didn't say that there is no afterlife, there is no heaven, there is no... He just said it's not important.
Yes.
What's important is this.
Yes.
And that we don't know. We don't really know those things. So we're focused on what we do know in terms of awakening here and now.
Yes, and what we can actually experience, which is awakening.
Right. But he didn't say there is that doesn't exist.
No, there's a very famous sutta, the Simsapa Sutta, which is the sutta on the handful of leaves. So the Buddha's walking with a group of monks and nuns through the forest, and he's anticipating that the conversation that's going on, and then one of the monks asks, I'm trying to remember it exactly, so I do justice to it. I can't remember the way the question was framed, but the Buddha answers. So the question was, how much do you know? What are you aware of? You're an awakened human being. How much do you know? What's your knowledge like? And the Buddha reached down and picked up a handful of leaves. And he says, what do you think? Is my knowledge like all the leaves on the trees all around us? Or is it like the leaves that I hold in my hand? And the response was, well, your knowledge is like all the leaves in the trees. And the Buddha says, yes, that's right. But I only teach what's in the palm of my hand, because this leads to the goal, this leads to unbinding. The rest of the knowledge that I have is completely immaterial to what I teach. And so he's implying that he may understand the grand cosmic questions that were always put to him, but they're unimportant to us for developing awakening, and they can only be a distraction. And the only until we have the understanding of a Buddha, of an awakened human being, which we all can do, then we can only speculate, which is what the Mahasanghikas did in the Second Buddhist Council. What Malankyaputta and Vajragoda and many others do. They remember, Malankyaputta was in seclusion, ostensibly practicing what the Buddha was teaching, and yet his mind went to these questions. And he insisted that the Buddha give him an answer if he was going to continue to be a disciple. So, the Buddha never said there's no such thing as heaven or reincarnation. Well, by implication, he's saying that there is no such thing as reincarnation. Because for me, there will be no future births. Meaning this self-referential ego self. He also said many times that him as an individual will never come back. There's much of modern Buddhism rests on the idea of a future Buddha coming back, much like a savior. The word that the name that's often given to that future Buddha is Maitreya. In fact, there's L. Ron Hubbard, who founded Scientology, claimed that he was Maitreya. He was the rebirth of the Buddha. There's a book that's really hard to find. The Song of the Himalayas, which is something that Scientology took out of print, but it was available up until maybe 15 years ago, which is L. Ron Hubbard explaining how he knows that he's the Buddha and this is, you know, this Maitreya, this future Buddha. Yet the Buddha said, I ain't coming back. I'm done. You know, his last teaching, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, said that I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. I've held nothing back. I've given you, meaning everyone, he was talking to Ananda at the time, I've given you everything you need for your own salvation. We don't need to get into any speculation. If we want to develop lives of lasting peace and happiness right here, right now, take to the Dhamma and put those other questions aside. Just to take it a little bit further, Debbie, if you think about what's most important in our lives, it's having a calm and peaceful mind right here, right now. And speculation about what might happen to me, even in the next moment, but certainly endless lifetimes in front of me, is only a distraction from what's occurring right now. So again, it's a very important question that the Buddha said is not important. It's just not important. It took me a long time, even after I started developing the Buddha's direct teachings, and I didn't even realize it at first, but there was still this subtle belief that I carried around with me of a supreme creator, God, or some type of universal system that was in some way watching out for me and that I could appeal to. And it was really incredibly subtle when I finally started looking at it. That there was still this underlying thing that there's got to be something out there. I don't feel that way anymore, and not
but that's
because
the thing we don't know.
Yes, and it was ultimately that clear and critical thinking that said, "Wait a minute, I can't know it. So why even think about it? There's no way of knowing it. So let it go." Why bother my mind with something that can only ultimately be speculation?
There's wars with that.
There are, and they're ongoing. And based on the dependent origination from ignorance leads to mental fabrications or assumptions. There's wars fought over those assumptions, those false beliefs rooted in ignorance. And the speculation that follows. And it's not just Muslims. There's near every religion. Yes, I will. I will say that nearly every religion is guilty of that. It's a confusing and deluded thinking that has a possibility of leading to things such as holy wars and crusades. Or even, and probably more important to recognize, just a hurtful behavior between one human being and another based on your assumptions. From ignorance leads to assumptions. And 10 more links, you have ongoing suffering. You're giving birth to suffering. The name of the new book, if I ever get it done, is called Becoming Buddha. And the title refers to exactly that. What are we becoming in this moment? Are we becoming awakened or are we becoming more ignorant? You know? Lauren, I'm sorry, you had your hand up.
Yeah, you said that the Buddha sat with his finger on the floor saying, "For me there will be no rebirth."
Yes.
No more becoming.
Yeah.
Doesn't that imply that if you're not awakened, there will be a more becoming, which would speculate that there are more lives or more...
Yes.
He's saying that for me, there will be no more becoming. After my life, I'm done.
As long as you've completed the task, meaning awakened.
He's awakened.
Yep.
But for the unawakened, he's saying that for you, there will be more lives.
Yes, but not. And we're really getting into semantics because if there's future lives, then there's got to be reincarnation. What he's talking about, though, is the ongoing process of becoming. And just like in a physical life from one moment to the next, there's continuity, and continuity obscures the impermanence of everything changing in each moment. And even though there's, and again, nobody's ever been able to answer the question, how much time is there between death and physical birth? So let's say we agree that there is such a thing as rebirth or reincarnation. How much time is it? Nobody knows. Is it an instant? Nobody knows that, okay, you died, and instantly, within moments, the Buddha used the word kalapas. 2,600 years ago, he described kalapas as something that they're just coming to understand today through science. He said Kalapas, he said millions and millions of Kalapas blink into existence and blink out of existence in the blink of an eye. And he said that that is the underlying sum and substance of all creation. So in some one way, he's describing kind of reincarnation, isn't he, through that. We were like, I could really get into a... Do you feel like spending a day here? what he's pointing out is that what we hold in mind, and this is getting into quantum... We talked about this on retreat, remember? When we got into quantum mechanics on Friday morning, I guess it was. Scientists, through the understanding of quantum physics or quantum mechanics, are able to show that it is the observer who's affecting what's being observed. Mm. Their thoughts are affecting that. Okay. The Buddha is describing the same thing. It's your thoughts, what you're holding in mind, that are affecting this underlying sum and substance of the universe, creating the experience that you're having. So yes, if you don't awaken... See you, Diane. It's good to see you this morning. Until you awaken, your thoughts are impacting this. Notice that I'm not saying me, but it seems like me, doesn't it? So unless we get our thinking in order, we're continually creating the situation, the conditions for ongoing birth.
Birth of what?
Birth of an ego. The word that is often used is samsara, wandering around in samsara endlessly, stuck in dukkha. Birth of what? Birth of an ego self. Birth of a self-referential ego self rooted in ignorance that is prone to suffering. Dukkha occurs. Dukkha occurs. What is the personal experience of dukkha? The five clinging aggregates. What are the five clinging aggregates? Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. Self-identity with these things. This is me. I am the same person. I was born 61, almost 62 years ago as the same person. Well, I'm not. Again, just logical thinking says that I'm not, even though I've inhabited the same physical form. It's only by perception and fabrications, perception and assumptions, that I can claim that this is the same me that was born September 5th, 1955. It's not. But nearly everyone on the planet would argue differently, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. It says on my birth certificate I'm the same person. My social security number insists that this is the same person. And it can never change. I like to think that I'm different than I was yesterday. If I'm developing the path, I am. I certainly know that I'm different than I was in a conscious way, even a year ago. I certainly am different than I was when I was 15 and thought that my future was center field for the Yankees. Didn't happen. No matter how much I clung to that idea, it didn't manifest.
So that rebirth is the Buddha's talking about the cycles or situations of your ego being reborn, but he's not talking about you coming back as a horse or another human being.
He never addressed that. That was something that was common even during the Buddha's time. And that really relates more to the caste system. The caste system during India, during those times, and it's still prevalent, is that once you were born into a certain caste,
you never got out of it.
No matter, and they believed in lifetimes. If you were an untouchable, that's it for life. But there was also, and this is getting into more of the religious ways that religion tends to control people, or it's used that way, that if you're really awful, you're going to be born, a frog or a snake. If you're really wonderful, you're going to be born a cow, and that's the reason why eating cows. We saw cows, and that we didn't. We see, and they still see cows as their ancestors. You don't want to be eating your mom or your dad or your kids, because there it is walking around on four hooves. That's the common belief. The Buddha never talked about that, never addressed that, because it just doesn't in any way relate to what he was teaching. So It's a great discussion and an important discussion. But again, it really comes back to, and it should remind us, what's most important right now is what am I giving birth to in this moment? Each moment holds the potential to incline the mind towards awakening or to continue ignorance, leading to more confusion, delusion, and suffering. And as we awaken, those questions become less and less important. You know, because we understand what's most important is the quality of my mind right now. It's really the only thing that we have any control over. And the quality of our mind, what we hold in mind in this moment, is going to determine what our experience is in the next moment. That doesn't mean that I can control. This gets into using your mind to create certain situations. Years and years ago, I came across a book, and some of you probably heard of it, called Creative Visualization by Shakti Gawain. I think that's how you say your name. And a lot of other teachings came from that. I used to read a lot of spiritual success books by U.S. Anderson and one of my favorite authors, I can't think, Ogmandino, etc., Napoleon Hill. And they taught that what you hold in mind will determine your success. And these were all spiritual success. Keep focusing on this and you can create great wealth or whatever else you might want. And I think there's a certain truth in that, but it's really a waste of mental energy to me. Because even those things that you might be able to create with an intense focus are all impermanent. And you're just creating an identity over that. The Buddha said that what's most important, what we should use as a frame of reference for what we hold in mind, is the Eightfold Path. Because that will bring us lasting peace and happiness. Lasting peace, not temporary peace, not impermanent peace. By letting go of all ignorant views of self, we create lasting peace and happiness in this lifetime. All right, so let's just go around the room if you have it. We've talked a lot, but I want to give you each an opportunity, Anthony.
Oh, thank you.
Good to see you.
I'm not going to say anything because I've asked a lot of questions about a sutta on the importance of not asking a lot of questions.
That's great.
But I thank you for putting this together. I mean, it's such a wonderful sangha where we can come and take refuge in.
Yeah, it really is.
Your instruction was amazing today. Yeah. And,
thank you.
Appreciate everyone's presence.
Thank you, Anthony. Jen, good morning. Good to
good
see
morning.
You.
Good to see you. Yeah, I guess this sutta kind of reinforced the idea that the focus is not the goal. It's right. It's what's ever occurring right now.
Yeah, and framing it properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of just the idea that we're moving through, sort of moving through each moment, kind of allowing the becoming of that moment, becoming of ourselves in that moment, and just kind of allowing that to happen rather than trying to direct it or understand it.
Yeah, be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state if that's what's occurring, and frame your, when the Buddha taught mindfulness as it relates to the Eightfold Path, he simply said to be mindful of the factors of the Eightfold Path, period. And that's the path that he gave. When he, the first teaching he gave, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he said, this is the path I teach, the Eightfold Path. That's what he discovered. He referenced that in, you remember on retreat too, he referenced that in the Nagara Sutta. This is what I teach. And the reason why he teaches it. To be mindful of what's occurring. Another way of saying that is to not have a distracted mind, to be well concentrated. But it's not enough to be well concentrated, we have to have a framework for that concentration to understand. That's why meditation alone will often just reinforce confused and deluded thinking, even though you might feel like you're gaining something. You know, in my position, I've found I've come across quite a few people that really concentrated themselves into a pretty hurtful space.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, it happens often. And sometimes it's not a recognizably hurtful space, but it's a completely diluted space. It's very, very hard to get out of.
Right.
You created the Buddha would call it a confining space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where looking out of that confining space, everything looks wonderful. But you're not understanding the process that's going on around you.
I think each factor kind of... that's the whole thing. It guides you. It kind of bumps you into concentrating on being in a state of becoming.
Yeah,
that's right. That's the most important thing. What am I becoming? Something that's so misunderstood in the Dhamma. Thank you, Jen. Eva, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be here with everyone. I've learned from experience because I did try the visualization route and it didn't work. And I have learned from experience that through practice of what the Buddha taught, I am getting everything that I was trying to visualize, though it's not what I was visualizing. And it's really something that words can't really fully explain, and therefore I understand how, you want to go to those questions of, what else is there, when really the answer is very... simple, and it's like playing a piano. You know that to play the music you have to sit a certain way and press these keys and all that, and it all sounds simple, but the reality is that it's a practice. You have to get your body into it, you have to get your mind into it, you have to get the self if those things are separate or together, but they do. I find that sometimes my body is doing something that my mind isn't agreeing with at that particular time, and it's amazing how, because of the environment, because of the space of the people that are around you, my body will start to go through changes that my mind doesn't that requires the Eightfold Path to say, okay, stop this, don't say that, don't make an effort over there, or to be with the group, step away, and it's such a simple and complex solution. I'm just glad that I feel that there are answers there that I find.
Yeah. Thank you. You're describing the feedback loop that the Buddha referenced in the Gara Sutta. We get stuck in those self-referential views. And there really is no way of getting out of it unless, that's why he developed an Eightfold Path. So a way to see that, clearly. That's a good metaphor, too, about learning how to play the piano. If you really want to learn to play the piano, but you get a book on drumming, the curriculum's wrong. You're not going to learn what you want to learn. The same thing here. If you want to learn about the cosmos and the great questions, you're not going to get it here, but you'll get other more important answers, I think. Thank you. Debbie, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. So, this was helpful in many ways, and it's also still confusing. And one of the things, my piece of my resistance to all of this has been that I didn't want to buy into another religion that is dogmatic and alienating others, because you go to war with it. And because I was brought up in Catholicism, which I rejected because of because this is the only way. So sometimes I feel like learning this is really helpful for me and important focus to just be in this world now, in this presence. And related to the question I asked, I also need to not be rigid in my thinking and to know that there may be more out there. I don't have to be distracted by it. But one time you said something about miracles don't exist or something, and you were saying something about miraculous, and you said, well, that doesn't really exist or something, and that got me stuck for a long time, because I do believe that there could be miracles, but I'm not going to get all wrapped up in whether there are or there aren't. I just believe there could be, and that's, I'm not going to reject other people's belief in miracles. It's just, for me right now, I'm understanding that I need to do this, live a better life, and use this path to live a better life and to come to peace in living that better life, because I'm not hurting others or myself.
Yeah.
So I can now have less resistance and grab on, because it's helpful to so many, but to myself.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but there was this piece, like, I don't want to get into a dogmatic religion. That was my resistance.
Yeah.
There's only one way to meditate. There's only one way to meditate. People need what they need. People are going to believe what they believe. I'm
yep.
going to reject what they believe. I'm going to do what's helpful about what I'm doing. It's helpful.
Yeah. I agree with you completely. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's difficult to say that it's this and it's not that, and not sound like you're saying that is not good or not right. And I've struggled with that. You know, how do I try to be as clear as I can by saying this is simply what the Buddha taught. But it doesn't mean that other things, other people might find helpful. But this is what the Buddha taught, you know. So the Four Noble Truths can be integrated into any belief system that you want. In fact, I would say it's probably helpful if you are in any belief system that you're involved in. If you can start developing the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, you'll see what you're doing in a much more mindful and clear way. And you may come to the same conclusions that the Buddha did and I did. You may not. And I would say that you're right. You probably heard me right when it sounded like I said there's no such thing as miracles, because I probably said it exactly that way. But I would say that I think miracles and anything else are possible. The difference is creating an identity over miracles, meaning if I do certain things long enough, then I will be rewarded with a miracle. There's the problem. It's the I. It's the self-identification. And to me, that's what separates what the Buddha taught from all dogmatic philosophies and religion. Because he's not teaching anything to be followed blindly in faith, but to be practically applied. Recognize and bring to cessation any aspect of I-making. And that's where usually religion reinforces I-making, but not necessarily. You know, I could see, from where I am right now, I wouldn't want to be, but I could see that being a practicing Roman Catholic and not being caught up in I-making over that, just something that I do. Of course, I don't, but, you know, the Buddha's Dhamma doesn't preclude anything except what you find might be continuing I-making. That's all. And there's nothing that he ever said you must do. You know, in other words, in order to save yourself, you must do this. He simply taught this path and said, Ehe Pasiko, come and see for yourself. There was never a threat that if you didn't do this, something awful would happen to you.
Right.
Never ever presented it that way. And I think that's where it differs from dogma. You know, it's up to you. Do it. You know, do it. If you don't want to do it, it's okay. Nothing awful is going to happen, except you're going to continue confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. But Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. I really don't have much to say, but I've sort of let my practice sort of wane a little bit just lately, and I think I've been enjoying the suttas and your teachings, and I've sort of supplemented learning for the actual practice, and really the two things are quite different. you can enjoy the learning in an intellectual level, but the actual practice of applying your butt to the cushion and applying the practice to your life is separate from the learning, even though it's the same practice.
Yeah.
Following the big umbrella of it, but and I think I've been sort of content in that I'm learning the suttas, learning the principles, and I could have, looking back, I could have been a little bit more diligent in meditation and bringing it into my life a little bit more, but if domestically things are going to change a little bit now from today onwards, so I think I'm going to get back into my my usual routine of literally practicing the practice, which is what I should be doing all the time. So I've never learned that slide. I've noticed it.
Thank you. You're describing being mindful of the entire Eightfold Path, including meditation. When the Buddha would describe that as when you're engaged in, well, let me relate it to the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort. When you're engaged in wrong effort, be mindful of it and enter and remain in, or be mindful of right effort, meaning we've got to put our time in on our cushions. But we also have to learn, and the first way that we learn is intellectually. And then from a well-concentrated mind, we're able to start integrating it, what is often referred to as the holy life, the holistic life, integrating the Eightfold Path as the framework for our life. The Buddha gave thousands of discourses, you know, because it was important to teach people what the Dhamma is. And he taught those all situationally. You know, again, everything relates back to the Four Noble Truths, but the words were different, the topics were different, the themes were different, but still... You first have to, that's how we communicate. Thank you for bringing it up. Any other questions or comments?
I just want to say thank you. It's been a really helpful discussion.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Very
good. It really, I have maybe a little bit broader perspective because I've been around different things, but it's really remarkable what's developed here in Frenchtown. We really are fortunate to have this, and it sounds like I'm not putting this all on myself. It's because of the people that come here and actually applying the Dhamma. I've been a member of many different sanghas, and nobody was seemed to be really developing what the Buddha taught. It's remarkable. And Saturday, Tuesday, and Thursday, it's really remarkable what's developed. So thank you all for being a part of that. Our next retreat is October 19th to the 22nd. The registration is up. If you're coming, please join, or please sign up as soon as you can. It helps my logistics. We're having our first annual Sangha picnic, July 15th, rain date the 16th, at Morris. Morris got a house with a lot of property and a nice pool just over the river. There's a link in the emails to the info on that. Be great. Everybody's welcome, family, friends, pets, anything you got, bring them with you. And there's a list of some foods to bring, and Maura's going to make some stuff too. So I hope you can all come with your family and kids and friends. All right, we'll finish with the Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.